thanks for the invitation to come along and talk about some of our experiences with canola in Australia. And we've been in the canola business, as John Kierkegaard said, since the 70s, and really in earnest since the 90s. And during that period, the key issues were the development of double zeros and also the development of better blackleg resistance in our varieties. I want to talk particularly about nutrition and some of the lessons we've learned over that journey. Just to give you a little context, again, Australia grows spring types, but we grow them over the winter. There is some penetration of winter types, but at the moment we're mainly concerned with spring types. The three production areas that we could sort of identify are in the west, in Western Australia, where they're basically grown on leached acid sands, and the nutrition is basically a hydroponic system there. There's almost no nutrition left in the soil, but there's lots of hydrogen ions, and the soils are incredibly acid. In South Australia and parts of southeastern Australia, we've got hypercalcic alkaline soils and issues with manganese, zinc and copper also come up there. And in Victoria, New South Wales, we've got divertisols. Some are calcic, some are hypercalcic, and as well as some chromosols, some acid duplex soils. So all in all, we've got somewhere around, I apologise, I'm going to have to talk hectares. Some of our farmers talk about hectacres, but we'll talk about hectares and kilograms, so I apologise from that. But we're somewhere around the 2.5 to 3 million hectares of canola, and we, to put that in context, that's we started in 1990 with 40,000, and it doubled every year. And another context is that's 1 kilogram per year for me since 1992. So that's my waistline, and has grown at the same rate as the canola acreage. The other, I suppose, one of the things to really appreciate about the difference that I've seen with my experiences in Canada with canola is that we sow about the same time as the Great Plains, but we harvest in November, October and November. And the reason that is because of the photothermal time during our winter is very short days, very cold days, not freezings always, no snow of course, but the duration during the vegetative phase is very long. And so farmers would typically sow in May, and the crops wouldn't start running up until July or August, and the first yellow flowers would appear in August. So it is a long period of time, and it does give farmers some opportunities to do nutrient management during that period, which I appreciate isn't necessarily the case in the Great Plains. Just to mention what the standard fertiliser practices are, the common strategies across all the canola regions are that P is applied at seeding, drilled, banded underneath or to the side, usually applied as MAP or DAP, and rates to supply about 20 kgs of P2O or 10 kgs of P. The nitrogen strategy is usually to have some little nitrogen at seeding, but more importantly to top dress nitrogen during the growing season as we become more sure of what the yield is. In terms of regional strategies, potassium isn't a common nutrient deficiency in the east. It is in the west, in the Western Australian regions, and in those cases, MOP is the common fertiliser banded. Sulphur is something that we have been working on for a long time, and sulphur strategies vary, particularly on, typically on light soils. The sulphur would be applied as ammonium sulphate or as gypsum, and gypsum and lime at seeding has become a big strategy on some of the eastern soils. There are also sulphur supplemented MAP fertilisers that are used at seeding, and there's also some UAN and ammonium sulphate fluid solutions that are available to be applied during vegetative growth. There are specific micronutrient issues that relate to soil type, year, and boron, manganese, molybdenum, acid sands, and manganese on highly calcareous soils are the characteristic deficiencies we would see. So in terms of what the lessons are, when we think about what the right rate is, there's two basic approaches. Soil test is one, and we use a bicarbonate extraction, which is a Colwell P, which is a modification of the Olsen P test. It's usually done on a 0 to 10 centimetre sample, and we consider a phosphate buffering index as part of that. The critical soil test range for that soil test is between 16 and 19 milligrams per kilogram, which is about the same as cereals. Maybe in some soils it's a little bit lower, lower than cereals, which suggests canola has a slightly higher P demand. Most growers and many of our soils are at or above those critical P levels, and so phosphorus is often now a maintenance strategy, and it's a replacement plus some soil demand. One of the key things we have learned is that P removal varies very greatly, and we've done some surveys of P content of canola, and it certainly varies from, although the textbooks would say 5 or 6, we know it varies from about 4 to 8. And so if you're using a phosphorus replacement strategy, actually knowing how much P is going off the field is a critical part. But typically with a 2.5 tonne per hectare canola crop, we would say that would remove somewhere around 14 kilograms of P, and we would think that depending on the phosphorus buffering index, it would need about another 1 to 4 kilograms of P to feed the soil. So that means the basic rate would be 75 kilograms of MAP or DAP to meet the phosphorus requirement. The lesson we first learned from that is that you don't use AP rates in seed rows with canola that you would have used with cereals, simply because of the amount of crop damage and the susceptibility of the canola to in-furrow seed damage. The safe rates of APs for cereals are much higher than the safe rates for APs with canola. And you're probably all aware of this, the concept of seedbed utilisation. The things that have changed now is that our growers, like the growers here, have gone to wider rows, 30 centimetres from 20 centimetres, and have gone from shares to minimum till and now to disc seeders. And the consequence is, if you look at the safe rates for DAP or MAP, which is in the table up here, those safe rates now are 20 or so kilograms, and if the guys are using MAP, 30 kilograms, which is a consequence of the ammonia. So our this has trapped a lot of farmers, and so that now we sort of are trying to convince them to modify their seeding to either use wider shares or to get seeding equipment that can twin shoot, separate seed and fertiliser. Particularly to the side, we've seen damage even if it's below by what you would think would be 1 inch or 2 inches to be safe, but we've seen damage. And although it has a great capacity to compensate for seeding loss, appreciate that hybrid canola seed is very expensive, and if you're going to burn half of it up with your fertiliser, then it's probably not a good strategy. The second lesson we've learned is that the most important thing for us is to get nitrogen right. And everybody knows that nitrogen will increase yield where there's a low nitrogen status, and growth and yield both respond, and this is an example of a typical experiment. And what we've learned is that the amount of water that's used doesn't change very much as you apply nitrogen. There's a small extra amount of water accessed, but in fact the main thing that the nitrogen does is improve the water use efficiency by making the crop, helping the crop grow with the same amount of water, more crop with the same amount of water, so the water use efficiency increases, and that's because the shading of the soil reduces the amount of soil evaporation that we have. And so that water use efficiency is the main beneficiary of good nitrogen management. But we also know that nitrogen decreases oil content. And someone asked yesterday about what was the relationship for oil and price. The price point at the moment is about 42% oil, and you're plus and minus 1.5% of yield per percent oil above or below that 42%. So there's a price bonus above 42 of 1.5% of the price, and a price bonus of reduction of 1.5% for each percent below 42. Not all growers sell bona fide seed. That says it's not all always oil tested, but certainly where oil bonuses apply, it's something to keep in mind. But despite that, the oil yield and the dollars per hectare increase with nitrogen strategies. Even though the oil content goes down and you may get a price penalty, it's virtually always shows that there's a benefit from nitrogen in terms of oil yield and dollars per hectare. So the lesson is about getting the right rate and reviewing. And we do have the ability to review during the season. And John yesterday mentioned that one of the key things we have is crop models using AppSim. This is actually a wheat simulation. And what this what a grower would do would be to take an assessment of what the soil water is and the soil nitrogen, and use a crop model through an internet web portal to look at what the probability weighted yield was. And the examples here are with and without nitrogen. And so at the median, the 50 percentile probability, in that case, this is a wheat yield, so I apologise, I didn't have a canola, but the wheat yield, the median wheat yield in that situation would be 5.5 tonnes without nitrogen in that field. The benefit, the potential benefit for nitrogen would take that wheat yield, the median wheat yield, to somewhere around 8 tonnes. So that's, we can see that from the crop model, and that is run every few weeks to make an assessment of what the soil water is doing and so what the potential yield is happening. And so that we would see that for every every inch of rain, for example, we'd see that that would mean for us an extra 18 to 20 kilograms of nitrogen to be rolled out on that crop to match up to with what the water limited yield potential was giving us. So the other thing that's probably quite different, but there's certainly we see, is that there's very little penalty for us to delay nitrogen, and that's why most growers would have minimum nitrogen at seeding and then roll it out as the season unfolds. And in this graphic, which was done from some field work with some farmers about top dressing early and late or splitting, really the key issue was the amount of nitrogen, not necessarily the time at which it was applied. And splitting early means usually at rosette stage, 3 to 5 leaf, and splitting late would be just as the stems are running up. And there really wasn't much difference there. Yes, 2 minutes. We also know that varieties do differ, and as we've moved from a triazine-tolerant, very low vigour, to high vigour varieties, we've seen that the higher vigour varieties have a much higher nitrogen demand. And this graphic is the dry matter in the bars and the nitrogen uptake with the black lines for three different nitrogen rates and a bunch of different vigour type varieties. And we'd say that if there was 50 kilograms of N supplied at seeding, either from the soil or from the fertiliser, that would be adequate to get the crop through to 4 to 5 leaf stage and without any yield penalty. And that's the strategy that most growers would consider. And even with the high vigour varieties, there may be some penalty, but the capacity to compensate is quite good. Fourth lesson, with 2 minutes left, 1 minute left, is that sulphur is something we've really done a lot of work with, and I don't know whether it was luck or good management. In the early years, we certainly saw quite strong sulphur responses, but with time we've seen reducing sulphur responses, even though the farming systems would suggest and the soil tests would suggest sulphur is less of a problem. So with sulphur, I'd say be alert but not alarmed. Monitor sulphur. I'm not sure about how good the soil tests are, but certainly keep an eye on that. What we have discovered is, again, that similar to the phosphorus story, the amount of sulphur that is in the textbooks about removal is quite a bit less. We would have said when we first started with canola that it was 8 kilograms of sulphur removed. Our measurements actually show it's more like 4. So therefore the nitrogen to sulphur ratio for nutrition is something like 10 to 1 rather than 7 to 1 as we would have thought. So that sort of issue about balanced nutrition has changed our sulphur demand, and it's almost enough sulphur out of soil organic matter mineralisation to supply the crops now. The final point I'd just make is that canola as a new crop attracts snake oil salesmen. And everyone will have some new silver bullet to help you grow canola better than anybody else. And it's a secret, and it only costs $3 an acre. So we know that canola is has a high capacity to capture zinc and copper. The other nutrients, molybdenum, if you've got an acid soil, you might need molybdenum. But really, if you do good wheat agronomy, lime soils, then the snake oil isn't all that much needed. So with that, I'd thank you. And if you want to, so we have a canola 4R nutrition manual that you can download off the IPNI website. There's also some other resources about canola nutrition. And IPNI is just going to produce a crop doctor series that you may have seen. There's been crop doctors for soil and for soybean and corn, and we'll have a canola one coming out in I don't know whether we're in spring or fall here, but soon. So thank you.
Thank you. One question, maybe?
It's virtually both. The seed analysis reflects very strongly the tissue analyses, but the numbers that were in that graph were seed removals. But we would use that 10-to-1 ratio between nitrogen and sulphur as a key for managing nutrition through the whole crop.
Okay. Thank you very much, Robert.
Okay. Thank you.